Well, all right. Moving right along. In 2002, the Cobb County, Georgia School Board of Education voted to put this sticker in the front of the biology textbooks. This sticker then was placed in thousands of ninth grade biology textbooks, and here's what the sticker says. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. Now, as you look at that statement and you see the thrust of the statement is talking about evolution. Evolution is an idea that at one point in time there was a single-celled life form. And that single-celled life form over millions of years in some type of genetic mutation added information and changed into multi-celled bacteria. And there again, over more millions of years and mutations, it added more information and changed into lower animals like talking about worms and then fish and then amphibians and then lower mammals, etc. And somehow from a single-celled life form, that life altered and changed over millions of years and arrived at humans as we are at the present. And that's the idea of evolution as presented in the textbook. In fact, what they suggest is, at some period of time in the past, there were no living creatures. There was no life. And life spontaneously sprung out of non-living chemicals. And then that life changed into the life that we have today. And so the people on the Cobb County, Georgia Board of Education felt like that this idea was not scientifically valid, did not have the robust scientific support that is often claimed for evolution, and so they felt like they needed to encourage their children to, when you hear the idea that a single-cell organism can somehow mutate and change into bacteria, you need to really think through that and not just let someone tell you what they say is happening. And you need to study that to see if that really does happen. Now, when this sticker was placed in the textbooks, the people who taught evolution and the people who claim that evolution is scientifically proven and is a theory that absolutely positively is true, well, they were angry with this sticker being put in the front of the textbook. In fact, so angry that they sued the Cobb County, Georgia school system, basically. And this sticker was then taken to the district court to see if it was constitutional to leave the sticker in the books. And it was said after much argument and much, all kinds of stuff, that this sticker was unconstitutional. And why, do you think, did they say this sticker was unconstitutional? Here's why. They said it was too religious. They said this sticker violated the separation of church and state that you find supposedly in the Constitution Bill of Rights, which you certainly don't really find the way that they present it to us. It's presented to us that if you have some type of activity or some type of material that is publicly funded, funded with tax dollars, then you cannot say anything about God, anything about Jesus, anything about the Bible, anything about Christianity. That is the furthest thing from the truth that you have ever been told in regard to the idea of the Constitution and the separation of church and state. You do understand that on our money, we have the statement, "In God we trust," and have had for multiple scores of decades. You do understand that the United States Congress has been opening with a prayer for over 150 years. You do understand that when the United States Continental Congress was meeting and we were going to war with England, that we took public funds to purchase thousands of Bibles from France because we couldn't get them from England anymore because the war was going on. The idea that somehow The separation of church and state means that a person cannot talk about God or Jesus in a public situation like a school is as false could be. But that's what you're told. But even if that were true, and it's not true, let's look at this sticker again and let's analyze all of the places that are so religious about it. Let's read it. This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered. Just point to the part that says anything about God. Jesus, the Bible, religion in any shape, form, or fashion. But this is the only way they could get this sticker taken out of the textbooks to say that it's too religious. Well, here's the problem. The problem is the story that is spun to us religious people is that you religious people are gullible, that you are not enlightened, you don't think through what you do, you sit in that church pew because your grandma sat in the church pew, and if you would think through the evidence and look closely at the information, you would arrive at a more enlightened understanding of the universe, and that understanding would not include God or anything spiritual, and you poor gullible religious people, you're just here because somebody in your past made a difference in your life and you've decided you're going to just open up your mind and let the preacher dump whatever he wants to in that. That's what you're told. And you're told that the enlightened thinking group of the people now are those people that are atheists and they're evolutionists, and these are the higher end scientific thinkers. But here's what I'm going to tell you is the absolute positive fact. There's a reason that people who want to teach evolution do not want this sticker in the textbooks. If a kid really did think through the information in the textbook that supposedly proves evolution, then that young lady or young man, if they were honest and really carefully studied and thought through and critically considered what they were looking at, would never ever believe in evolution. And deep down in the hardcore evolutionist heart, they know that. And so they can't encourage young people to think through what's being taught to them in the school system on evolution. In fact, what they want to say is, don't think through it right now. You can think through it later. You can critically analyze it when you're older. But right now, just let us tell you what to think. Now, Christianity is the exact opposite of that. In fact, Paul said to every single person, test all things, hold fast to what is good. Sadly, I do think sometimes in the church we have not had answers to certain questions, and so we have discouraged some of our younger people from asking us questions, but in a lot of places I don't see that being the case. And in many cases I see the healthy understanding of whatever question you have. Let's work through it together. Let's see what the Bible says about it. Let's see how we can find an answer to this. And let's look through and study carefully what our religion and Christianity is all about. Now, here's what I'm going to tell you. I've been working at Apologetics Press now for 20 years and have had about every question under the sun thrown at me. And the more I look at the challenges to Christianity and the accusations that unbelievers have against the Bible, etc., the stronger and stronger my faith is and becomes as I see that Christianity is the only perfect philosophical system ever devised on this planet. There are no holes in the ideas of Christianity. It is based on factual information, historical information, and is perfectly consistent all the way throughout. Now, every now and then, somebody will throw you a curve, and you'll think, wow, how does that fit with what I understand about Christianity? I don't, and you might know, but if you will dig in deep and determine you're going to find an answer, when you do that, you come out of that discussion and that study as a stronger Christian. If you decide to dig in deep to evolution and determine you're going to find an answer, you will not come out a stronger evolutionist. In fact, that's what I'm going to show you this morning. As you are presented this information in the evolutionary textbooks, evolutionary-based textbooks. One of the first things that you're going to run into is the concept of life. Now, life is very complex. We've got DNA that is a coded message system that is the basis for all life. That coded message system is very, very complicated in many ways. You understand that. And when we as creationists, people who believe in God, ask the people who do not believe in God, and who believe in an evolutionary-based system, where did life come from? The answer that we get is life came from non-living chemicals. It just somehow arose from something that was not alive. Now, the problem with this idea is that in every single biological experiment ever done, we see life in this world coming from previously existing life of its own kind. Now, that's the law of biogenesis. Now, remember we said that a law is something that has never seen a single exception, never one time. Years ago, they did not understand the law of biogenesis. In a number of ways, they didn't understand it, and so they said, you can just get life to pop into existence from non-living chemicals. And when someone said, well, what do you mean you can get life to pop into existence from non-living chemicals? They would say, well, look at a T-bone steak in the middle of the summer on your kitchen counter. Put a T-bone steak in the middle of the summer on your kitchen counter, open the window, and wait 2 weeks. Do you know what you will have on that T-bone steak in a couple of weeks? You will have maggots. Did you see any maggots crawl onto the steak? Did you see any maggots fall from the sky onto the steak? Where do the maggots come from? They come from the spontaneous generation of life from the chemical in the airs and the chemical property of the meat, and maggots form. Well, about 1660, a man by the name of Francisco Redi said, you know what, I'm not sure that maggots actually do form spontaneously. I'd like to do some experimentation on that. And so he did a real simple experiment. He put some meat in the bottom of a jar, left it open, put some meat in the bottom of a jar, sealed it, and waited to see what happened. Well, you're going to read this in virtually every single biology textbook that you ever study. You're going to read about this experiment. Flies landed on the meat that was unsealed. Flies did not land on the sealed meat. Maggots formed on the unsealed meat. Maggots did not form on the sealed meat. People said, well, that's no kind of experiment because you didn't let the air get back in to the meat. And he said, oh, okay, well, let's try a third element to this experiment. Sealed meat, unsealed meat, meat in the middle that has a gauze-type substance, a netting substance on the top of it, so air gets in, but the flies couldn't. Maggots formed on the meat that was unsealed. No maggots formed on the meat that was sealed. Maggots formed on the netting, gauze-type fabric that was covering the meat, but not on the meat. And he said, there you go. I believe that flies produce maggots. And they said, wow, that's interesting. That is amazing. I guess you've disproved the maggot idea. So do you still think that life doesn't spontaneously generate? He said, no, I think other life does, just not maggots. That was in 1600. Now, by 1860, there was an experiment done that proved, validated, verified the law of biogenesis once and for all. It was actually a lengthy experiment, if I understand it. It took several months, maybe even years. A man by the name of Louis Pasteur came up with a system by which you flash boil liquids that would have microscopic organisms in them. Because, see, by 1860, we had developed microscopes, and you could zoom in on some meat broth or hay broth, and you could see little stuff swimming all over the soup there. And you guys understand exactly what's going on here. If you were to cook some chicken noodle soup and you leave it in your kitchen without covering it and without putting it in the refrigerator, and leave it there for a week or two and come back and decide you're going to eat it, are you going to have some problems with that? Yeah, now you won't have maggots maybe in it, but there will be stuff that if you had a microscope and you zoomed in and you saw it, you would see all kinds of little stuff swimming around in there. And so by 1860 they could. Now Louis Pasteur did this experiment in which he took meat or hay broth and boiled it in a special flask with an S-shaped curve as the neck. Now, the S-shaped curve was very important because it let air come back into the meat broth or the hay broth, but it caught all the microscopic organisms in the bottom of the little S-shape. And so he would boil the hay broth, he would zoom in the microscope, he would let anybody that wanted to look at it to see that there were no microscopic organisms in it at the time, and then he would wait. Sometimes he would wait a month, zoom back in, no microscopic organisms. If I understand it right, some of them he boiled and would wait a year. And that S-shaped curved flask would catch all the microscopic organisms that would try to get in there for a whole year. But immediately when he broke the neck off of the flask and the air came straight back into the meat broth or the hay broth, well, immediately microscopic organisms formed. You see, since 1868, we have known that the law of biogenesis is the biological law, that life comes from previously existing life of its own kind in nature. It's a fact. There's never been a single exception to that. Now, as you look at that, and you compare it to what you hear about evolution, you see, according to the atheistic idea of evolution, at some period of time, there had to be non-living chemicals that gave rise to life. Life had to come from non-living chemicals. And yet, according to the law of biogenesis, that simply cannot happen. And so the evolutionary atheistic scenario of life coming into existence from non-living chemicals, well, that is a validated, verified impossibility according to the biology we understand to be scientifically proven and experimentally based. And what I mean by that is millions of experiments have been done trying to get life to come from non-living chemicals, and it does not happen. Now, here's the second aspect of the evolutionary idea that is completely at odds with the most fundamental law of biology. The second aspect is, supposedly once life pops into existence from non-living chemicals, which we've shown cannot be the case, well then that life changes from one kind of life to another kind of life. It changes from a single-celled amoeba to a multicell bacteria, and from a multicell bacteria to a worm. Now here's the second problem with that. The law of biogenesis says life comes from previously existing life of its own kind. Now, you understand this very well. When I was, I was probably about third grade, we had a dog named Max. And Max was, she was going to have babies, and we were moving at the time. And so I remember putting Max into the U-Haul truck, and we were taking off on a 2 or 3 day drive to move where we were going to have our new home. And Max, actually, during the trip, had her babies. And I remember getting Max out of the U-Haul truck and putting her in the bathtub. And the next day, we went into the bathtub to see Max's babies. And there were 8 of the most beautiful baby hippopotamuses you have ever seen. They were pygmy hippopotamuses, but they were hippopotamuses. And we sold those hippos to zoos, and that's how I went to Fried Hardeman University. And that, did my dog give birth to 8 baby hippopotamuses? Okay, now, lots of times the person who believes in evolution will say, Kyle, you're caricaturing this idea. We don't say that a dog gives birth to a baby hippopotamus. We would say that a dog gives birth to, well, to what? You see, the fact of the matter is, if you have a dog and it gives birth to something, guess what it is every single time it gives birth to something? It's always a dog. Well, what if I said, you know what? No, it wasn't a baby hippopotamus. Actually, it was a half dog, half bird. The top of it was feathers, the bottom of it had fur, and it was the neatest thing. Well, you wouldn't believe that. What if I said, okay, no, it wasn't half dog, half bird. Actually, it was a 99% dog, 1% lizard. Had one little scale right here on the top of its head. We called it a dizzard or log, and it was the cutest little thing you have ever seen. Would you believe that? Okay, no, you know that if a dog is going to give birth to something, it always, in every case, gives birth to a dog. Every time. Now, this is where you got to be real careful. Because a sleight of hand trick comes in from the evolutionary writing and literature that if you are not fairly sharp and understand what's happening, then you miss it. Follow along with me. According to the biblical idea and what we understand about God, what is stronger than God? Nothing. What am I holding in my hand? Nothing. So what I'm holding in my hand is stronger than God. Well, it's some kind of trick there. You know that something fishy is going on there, but maybe it's hard to see exactly what is happening there. There's something called equivocation. Equivocation is when a word has two definitions and somebody gets you to agree to one of them and then puts the other one in for the word in a different place. Let me show you what I mean. If you were just to open your book on biology and you read about evolution, here's what they will say. Evolution is change over time. Now, do things change over time? Absolutely positively. Do you look like you looked when you graduated from high school? Yes, absolutely. My man up here says, yeah, I look even better than I looked when I graduated from high school. Okay, now some stuff changes over time. In fact, lots of things change over time. So if we were going to say, is evolution true, then the person writing the evolutionary-based textbooks would say, well, do things change over time? Now, what are you forced to say about that? Yes, things change over time. So evolution is true. Well, yes, if evolution means change over time. So we evolve from amoebas. Okay, you see the trick there? There's two definitions of evolution. One is change over time. One is the addition of multiple billions of bits of genetic information by random chance processes to get an amoeba to a person. Now, change over time actually sure happens. Adding millions of bits of genetic information to get an amoeba to a person does not happen. Now, here's what you find out. You find out that change over time runs into barriers that stop the genetic change. And let me tell you what I mean by that. What if you could run a mile in 10 minutes? And you were talking to your, maybe it was a high school track coach, and he said, you know, I think you can do better than that. And you say, okay, I'm going to train. And so for a week you train, and you shave off a minute of your time. And so now you run it in 9 minutes. Well, you train for another week, and you shave off a minute of your time, and now you run it in 8 minutes. You train for another week, and in 3 weeks you have shaved off 3 minutes of your time, and you started at 10 minutes, and now after 3 weeks you're running in 7 minutes. Follow the thought, in 10 weeks how fast you're going to run a mile. It's going to take you 0 minutes. You see, what we're told is if you look at change in the animal kingdom, well, let's say you have some finches, and in 10 years their beak size changes by 0.3 centimeters. Well, if they could change by 0.3 centimeters in 10 years, what could they do in a million years? Well, at some point you run into a barrier. You run into a wall that you just can't go any farther than, and that's the kind. You don't get a bird ever to add information that would change it into a cat. It's impossible to do. Biologically, it doesn't happen. It violates the law of biogenesis that life comes from previously existing life of its own kind in nature. And so as you look at this law of biology, you don't have to go any further than the most fundamental law of biology to deal with evolution. Just a quick question. According to evolution, especially the atheistic proposition of evolution, did life somehow originate from non-living chemicals? Yes. What about the law of biogenesis? What's it say? Can't happen. Once that life came into existence, did it change from one kind of life to another kind of life according to evolution? Yes. Experimentally speaking, have we ever seen life change from one kind of life to another kind of life? Never. Dogs always have dogs. Cats always have kittens. Do you know we've been zapping the fruit fly for the last 100 years with radiation and every type of chemical anomaly we can give it to change the fruit fly to something besides a fruit fly? You know, we can make a fruit fly grow wings on its head. We can make a fruit fly grow legs on its head. We can make a fruit fly grow 6 pairs of wings or no pairs of wings or legs where its wings are supposed to be. We've been zapping them with radiation to mutate their genetic information for 100 years, and after 100 years, which would be the equivalent of millions of years of evolution if there ever were such a thing, do you know what you still got? It's still a fruit fly. It's never changed even to a different kind of fly. It's still just a fruit fly. And so if you're going to start looking at this critically, considering this information, the law of biogenesis is as far as you've got to go. And if you were just to say, in a nice, kind way, when a teacher said it, have we ever seen one kind of animal change to another kind of animal in real time, in real experience? Well, we've never seen it, but it must have happened in the past. No, have we ever seen it? No. You've never seen it because, number one, it's a law of what we know to be validated by experimental science. And then if you just wanted to back it up with a biblical statement, go back to Genesis chapter 1, and on day 3, God makes the flowers, grass, and trees, and He says, be fruitful and multiply after your own. And then on day 5, He makes the birds and fish, and He says, be fruitful and multiply after your own. The law about Genesis was stated in Genesis chapter 1, and it's been verified and validated by every single experiment ever done in biology. And that's a fact. Okay, so that's as far as you need to go, but then you'll have other stuff like this. See, this is in virtually every single biology textbook that you'll ever see. It's the English peppered moths. English peppered moths that supposedly show us evolution in action. And here's what we're told. Before the Industrial Revolution, the moth population was 95% light-colored and 5% dark-colored. And we're told that's because birds could see the dark-colored ones better. And so birds would eat the dark-colored moths, and they would leave the light-colored moths alone. And so that's why the population was 95.5. And then after the Industrial Revolution, when the soot killed all the lichens on the trees, then the moth population ratio changed from 95% light to 95% dark, and then from 5% dark to 5% light. And we're told, there again, that birds could see the light-colored moths on the soot-stained trunks of these trees, and that's why the population changed. And if you'll notice the very bottom of this, it says that this is, notice it, evolution in action. Okay? Now, is this some kind of change in the moth population? Yes, so watch out for the equivocation. If evolution is change over time and the moth population changed, did it evolve? Okay, yeah, but then what they're really trying to show you is that this means you could get a moth to turn into a bird. Well, no, you can't, and there's a couple reasons why this particular study is so aggravating to me. And here's why. You know, sometimes if you don't look real carefully, you'll miss. If you just, you ever watch a magician where he's doing a trick, but he does a lot of flary stuff with this hand over here, and there's a lot of movement, and he's trying to get you to watch this hand, and with this hand he's doing the trick, but he's moving this hand so much that you're watching this the whole time? Did you ever stop to think when you saw these pictures in your books? They've been in there for decades. I mean, since the 50s. You ever stop to think how they get those pictures of those peppered moths on there? You know, isn't that really convenient that they just line up perfect for us? I mean, if you've ever tried to take Easter pictures with three kids, you understand that stuff doesn't just line up perfect to fit perfectly in the photograph view of the... Oh, you know, that is so convenient that these English pepper moths, well, they lined up for the photographer on a lichen-covered tree, and then somehow they lined up for him on a dark-colored tree, and wow, that is just amazing. That's a well-trained English pepper moth, isn't it? Except the problem is, that's not a well-trained English pepper moth at all. They just glue those on there. Or they capture them, artificially place them on there. And if I understand it right, in the last about 50 years, English pepper moths have only found ever, like, two pairs landed on a tree trunk. They don't land on a tree trunk. Not very much at all. They land on the underside of green leaves. And so the idea that somehow these birds are seeing them on the tree trunk, well, that's not even really true. Oh, and now incidentally, what you'd hope is that these guys would not know that these English pepper moth pictures are fake. But they do. They know it. And now listen to the statement. I mean, you got to look at the audience. How convoluted do you want to make it for a first-time learner? He said, we know this stuff's not really right, but if you make it any more detailed or convoluted, then it just confuses the poor kids. Okay? Well, the advantage of this example of natural selection is it's extremely visual. Well, you can really see it well. It's false, but you can see it real good. But let's see how that would work. Suppose I say that I've got some white cows, and when the white cows eat green grass, they grow purple spots. And I bring my white cows, and I show you that they're eating green grass, and after our Bible class period, you go out there, and sure enough, they've all got purple spots about the size of a baseball. And one of you goes up to them, and you pet that cow, and you think, wow, that's amazing. They really did grow purple spots. And then later, your forehead itches a little bit, and you scratch it, and your wife looks over at you, and she says, honey, what you got on your head? Well, you look, and sure enough, on your hand and on your head, you got some purple. And you go in the bathroom and you get it off and you realize you got purple paint. Well, you go to that cow that you petted and it's been smeared, and you come to me and you say, Kyle, that's not It's not a purple spot that the cow grew. You painted that on there. And I said, yeah, but the advantage is it's extremely visual. You can see it real well. And it doesn't matter if it's fake, they're saying, it just makes the point so well. Okay. Now look at this. And catch it close. We want to get across the idea of selective adaptation. Later on, they can look at the word cow more critically. Now remember what that sticker said. Now, this statement is not in any way really related to the sticker from 2002. But in another way, it's very closely related to it, isn't it? You see, that sticker said, this information on evolution should be looked at with an open mind, studied carefully and critically considered. What Bob Ritter is telling you is, if they critically considered it now, yeah, they might reject it. So let's wait and let them do that later. If they'll just be quiet and let us dump this into their mind without thinking about it, well, that'll be their best bet right now. Just incidentally, when is later on that they are supposedly encouraged to think about this more critically? Is it upper high school? Hey, all the stuff we told you proved evolution, that doesn't really, let's go over that now. Evolutionary false information 101 in college? No, in fact, lots of people have gone to the PhD level and they have never stopped to critically consider this information that the people have known to be false, and they put it out there anyway and say, don't think about it, just trust us. Now, here's what else is very, I think, humorous about this particular incident. Let's say it was the case that English peppered moths landed on tree trunks. They don't, but let's say it was. Do you have evolution happening then? Okay, hold on just a second. You had the genetic information in the moth population before the Industrial Revolution to have two varieties of moth. What were they? Dark and light. After the Industrial Revolution, you had the genetic information in the moth population to have two varieties of moth. What were they? Dark and light. Did you add any new genetic information? Did you get the moth to have a beak? Did you get it to grow any fur? Look, suppose we did this. We have a dog that gave birth to 10 puppies. 6 of them were light-colored, and 4 of them were dark-colored. Okay, so now we've got a 6-4 ratio of light to dark-colored. Now, the mom is walking across a frozen pond. Tragically, the pond is thinner than she thought, and 5 of the light-colored puppies sink into the pond. And now we have a puppy population of 4 dark and 1 light. What do we have? Evolution in action. Because the ratio of light to dark changed. Was that what you've got? No, you don't have evolution in action. You've got nothing. There's no new genetic information that was added to the moth population. And yet, that is used as one of the key ideas as to how we can prove evolution in virtually every single textbook. This guy right here, his name is Ernst Haeckel. Ernst Haeckel read On the Origin of Species by Natural Selection in 1860 in German. He read it in German because in 1859 it came out and was translated immediately into multiple languages and shipped all over the world. And when he read it, he thought, this is the greatest biological idea that I have ever heard, and I'm going to prove it to be true. Now, this was in 1860. And he came up with what he called the law of embryology. And the law of embryology, he said, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. That sounds smart, doesn't it? I mean, it just makes you feel like you know more. Just repeating it. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. What in the world does that mean? Well, here's what it meant. He said that you could look at an embryo in a various stage of its growth and you could see its evolutionary history. Ontogeny is the growth of an embryo. Phylogeny is its supposed evolutionary history. So ontogeny, the growth of the embryo, recapitulates, recaps, it goes through again the phylogeny of the organism, its evolutionary history. So basically he said, look, everything starts out with fish gills. And if you were to zoom in on a human at a certain period of time, you would see it has fish gills, just like a fish has fish gills, just like a turtle has fish gills. And if you wait a few weeks or months and zoom in again, you're going to zoom in at like a lizard stage. And then if you wait a few months again, you're going to zoom in at something like a lower mammal stage. And you can just zoom in at the right time and you'll see it all there in its ontogeny, in its embryological development. He said it just recaps its evolutionary history. And everybody said, wow, you know, that is remarkable. You know, I was talking to a person. Lots of times we get feedback at AP, and lots of it's not friendly at all. In fact, we'll get stuff like this. Hey, everything on your website is ridiculous. You guys are lying. You need to get rid of all of the things that you have on there and step into the 21st century scientific era and quit trying to drag our kids back to the dark ages. Stuff like that. Now, what I always try to do is be very kind to the people who are writing to us, but get them to identify single ideas that we can then get in a discussion about. And so I will say, hey, appreciate you reading our material. I'll have to respectfully disagree with your assessment of it, but could you give me the one idea that you think proves the atheistic evolutionary ideas that you are holding to and you say that we should change to? And I had a person that wrote us, and I said basically that, and he said, yes, I can. He said, and one of his, he gave me two, and he said, one of the primary ideas that proves evolution to be true is that humans have gill slits when they are developing as embryos. Okay, just exactly like Ernst Haeckel taught in 1880 or so, actually 1880, when he was teaching this. Okay, so I said, all right, let's go from there. Let's work with that. Here's the problem. During Haeckel's time, the people who studied embryos said, Haeckel, where did you get those pictures? Because they don't look anything like the embryos we study on a regular basis. They said, you know, that salamander embryo you drew, that's real convenient and all, but it doesn't look like the salamander embryo at that stage of development that we see. And that fish that you've got with the beautiful little fish gill looking things right there, well, when we zoom in on the fish embryo at that stage of development, we don't even see what you're talking about. Where'd you get these pictures? He said, well, I did draw some from memory. And he said, sometimes I'd draw the same embryo and label it three different things. A dog, a pig, a human. And it'd be the same embryo. Oh, and incidentally, those aren't gill slits. They never have been gill slits. They are folds that develop into other things, but they have nothing whatsoever to do with gills or gill slits. Now, we have known that since 1880. And this is a statement in Natural History from a man named Stephen Jay Gould, who was at the time that he was alive, was probably the most well-known evolutionary biologist that there was. And he wrote an article titled Atrocious: How Haeckel's Distortions Did Not Help Darwin. And basically, he then said, Haeckel remains most famous today as the chief architect and propagandist for a famous argument that science disproved long ago. Well, and then he said, I don't know if you can read this, but it's very interesting. Yeah, you can read this. We should therefore not be surprised that Haeckel's drawing entered 19th century textbooks, but we do, I think, have a right to be astonished and ashamed by a century of... Oh, well, hold on just a second. Why are you astonished by a century of mindless recycling? What have you been asking the kids to do? Don't look at this carefully. Don't study it critically. Don't look into it very closely. Just let us tell you what to believe about this stuff. We do, I think, have the right to be astonished and ashamed by a century of mindless recycling. That's what they have been trying to develop the kids to do. Don't think through it. Just take our word for it. And this is what happens. You get 100 years of mindless recycling. And so I didn't have to answer the person who wrote to us. I gave him this information and said, you do know that for the last 100 years we've known that humans don't have gill slits as they develop in the womb. Okay, now this guy said that this was the number one piece of information, at least one of his top two. And here's what he wrote back to me. Now catch this. He said, well, that just proves why evolution is better than creation. Because we can change with the evidence, but you guys are stuck with the creation account. Okay, well, number one, the creation account meshes with real science perfectly. And there's never been a verified, singular, ever experiment done that has shown anything in the creation account to be wrong or incorrect. Now, it just so happens that the creation account is exactly right and will always be exactly right. But the second aspect of that is, you just told me that the biggest reason you believed in evolution and atheism was this, and I showed you that wasn't right, and you never even checked up. You never even thought, I might need to reassess what I've been thinking all these years. I might need to reevaluate how I have been approaching this. No, you never even stopped. You immediately jumped from, oh yeah, well I guess that's wrong, but, and never even stopped to think about it. Why? Because it's not evidence-based. It's not driven by a pursuit to know the truth. It's driven by mindless recycling. Now, I'll finish this with a couple of stories. Very interesting. I was in Swartz Creek, Michigan, and it was a youth rally and had probably, 100 kids or so, and delivering this material. I've been delivering this same material for 20 years, or pretty close, 15, 16, in one shape, form, or fashion. And we'll probably continue for the next 20 years because it still is in the textbook. Now, this young lady was in the lecture that I was giving on this. She wrote me an email back, I think it was the next week, and she said, Kyle, let me tell you what happened. I sat through your lecture on the evolutionary teaching and things of that nature. She said, the next week in biology, the next week, we had a chapter on evolution and the proofs that they used to teach evolution were the English peppered moths and Haeckel's embryos. She said, I almost laughed out loud because I had seen what you showed us about those. That's encouraging. Except she was in a class of probably 35 other freshmen that weren't at that lecture. And they were encouraged to just accept that without critically considering it, without studying it carefully, without looking at it with an open mind, and just, hey, you'll figure it out later. Just trust us for now. And how many of those ninth graders did just trust them for now and then end up like that individual who wrote to me, and they're so solidly embedded in the evolutionary teaching that they've swallowed for so many years, they don't even stop to think when somebody says, oh, the main idea that you presented that you said proved evolution, we know it's not true, and your people have known it's not true for 100 years. Well, let me finish with an encouraging story about a man named Mike Houts. Mike Houts is a good friend of mine. He is a project manager at NASA as a rocket scientist. That's what he is. He got a PhD from MIT, I believe, and is one of the most brilliant men you will ever talk to. He's one of those guys that uses big words because that's how he thinks, and he's not using them to impress you in any way. I'm fairly intelligent, got a master's degree too, and I sit down with Dr. Houts, and he'll start talking, and I'll have to interrupt him and say, Dr. Houts, could you define the last two words you used there? He's high end. Now, Dr. Houts grew up as an atheist. He grew up in an atheistic family. Nobody encouraged any type of critical thinking about the evolutionary teaching that he was getting all through college and all through his university years. And at some point, he stopped in his life and said, hold on. I've been told that there's no God and that the evidence proves that's true and that evolution is the case and that the evidence proves that's true, but I've never really looked into it. So I'm going to start. And he started looking into it. And he quickly, after some critical analysis, realized that all he had been taught about evolution and how that proved that life came from non-living chemicals and then eventually evolved into humans, he saw that that wasn't the case. And he saw that there is a God. So he studies himself out of atheism into the idea of creation. He then studies himself out of the idea of evolution into understanding God created everything. And then he says, okay, so now let's see if there is a God and he created everybody, let's see what that God wants from me. And started studying the Bible and studied himself into New Testament Christianity. And is a Christian today because at some point in his life, he stopped and said, hold up, I'm going to start looking at this and asking myself, is it true? And I'm going to start looking at it with an open mind and critically consider it and carefully study it. And here's what I'm telling you will happen every time. If you critically consider and carefully study what's being taught, and you have an honest heart, and you're going to follow the evidence where it leads, you will always arrive at the conclusion that there is a God, that the Bible is God's Word, that Jesus Christ is God's Son, and that there is a plan for your salvation that is clearly outlined in the Bible that you can obey and you can become a New Testament Christian and look forward to being saved eternally after this life is over. And that's where critical consideration and careful study will lead the honest-hearted person. You guys have been so kind this morning. I appreciate it greatly and am glad that you are here. Look forward to our final lesson of the series this morning for the sermon hour, and it's going to be on giving our children a defensible faith. Thank you.